Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lauren, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens line. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I'm also the GM for Valiant, and I write the Monsters Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren, your Dova Queen, and I've been playing RPGs for almost 20 years. I write the Bend the Knee blog here on No Direction, and you can also watch me play in the Adventurous and Three Ring Adventure podcasts.
And this episode, just like last time, is a little different from what we usually have around here. We're here to help all of you who have been interested in playing Pathfinder and are coming in from other games. You have some kind of role-playing experience, maybe a few sessions or even years and years of campaigns under your belt, but you want to try out Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Consider us your guides to the magic world of Pathfinder.
In this mini-series, the last episode was if you're brand new to role-playing games in general. This episode is going to be about if you're coming in from different role-playing games, and the next one will be some tips and tricks from both our listeners and from us.
You've probably heard of Pathfinder, which is why you're here in the first place. If not, hey, lucky us that you found us somehow. Welcome. Pathfinder is a fantasy role-playing game with lots and lots of fun rules to help your game out. I know a lot of people don't like it when we say this, but it is similar to Dungeons and Dragons and other fantasy games you might have heard about before, except that the big thing about Pathfinder is just how customizable the game is. There's lots of rules to let you do almost anything, fulfill any kind of fantasy you have in your brain.
So, Luis, I've been doing this for a long time, right? I got my start in 2nd edition Dungeons and Dragons when way back in the day. I can't remember if 3rd edition was already out or if it was about to come out. But I've been doing this a long time. Thaco was the worst. And then we went to 3rd edition. And 3rd edition was fun, but it had its problems. But 3.5, man, that was the sweet spot. And I think a lot of other RPG gamers kind of feel the same way about 3.5 being a sweet spot. But this is what made Pathfinder so cool, is 3.5 wasn't perfect. When 4th edition came out, and it wasn't really what everybody was looking for in a game, Pathfinder said, hey, we know you love 3.5. Here's more of that, but with some improvements to the system. And man, I mean, I've been enjoying Pathfinder for a long, long time. I've tried out 5e. It's okay. I've had fun with it. And I honestly believe that 5e and 1st edition Pathfinder were about the same level of quality, but for very different reasons. Pathfinder being a lot more crunchy, having a lot more system to allow you to explore your character in a mechanics sense. Whereas 5e's a lot simpler and easier to bring new players in. But this is why my new favorite of all time is 2nd edition Pathfinder. Because it took all of the flexibility and all of the mechanics crunchiness that we love from 1st edition, and it made it easier. It made it more wieldy. Luis.
More wieldy.
Luis, I've never heard this story. How did you get started in role-playing games?
Well, I guess I'll start. There's a lot of spots I could start, but I'm going to start in high school when I skipped track practice one day to go play Dungeons & Dragons 3.5 with a couple of my friends, and I started up my first halfling rogue and had a good time, and then I did that for about 2 years until they all ran off to college and left me alone with no one to play. But a few years later, I'm playing 4th edition Dungeons & Dragons because we meet up again. You know, a few years later, and I'm enjoying it. I'm liking it a lot. I'm homebrewing a lot of stuff, telling a lot of stories, and not too long after, I find an image of the artwork from the second cover of the Pathfinder Adventure Path, second Return of the Rune Lords, which has a bunch of ghouls coming out of a well, and there's like a spooky haunted house in the back, and it said, "Foxglove Manor, the scariest night you'll ever have in D&D. I thought, what is this? So I looked into it, and I realized people write adventures so you can just run them, and I don't have to come up with stuff, and these adventures are really cool, and I like the story that's going on, and I just fell in headfirst into Pathfinder because I love their adventures. And soon enough, I'm buying every single Pathfinder thing there is and making sure to fill out the back part of the catalog that I missed, you know, because I'm a few years late. And I played Pathfinder First Edition basically a few months after it had come out to, you know, when it finally turned over to Pathfinder Second Edition. So I really liked how it improved on the 3.5 stuff, and I loved the setting and everything that came with it. And seeing it evolve into second edition from within Paizo itself was pretty cool, and having a part of that. And now it's still got a lot of that simulationist feel that 3.5 and Pathfinder had, but it's not afraid to just have fun, ridiculous, exciting things just kind of built in without you needing to, you know, spec specifically into, oh, I need a plus 40 to my acrobatics to be able to tumble through and like fall and not take any damage. It's just kind of built into the game now. You don't have to go and do all this ridiculous stuff to do one specific cool thing. There's a lot of cool things already built in, and it's just a lot more fun and a lot more manageable too.
Since this episode is all about if you're coming from other versions of role-playing games, there's too many role-playing games for us to mention them all. So we're going to specifically talk here some general summary stuff of 2nd Edition, and we're going to talk more specifically about if you're coming from 1st Edition Pathfinder or 5th Edition D&D. But some of the key mechanics of Pathfinder 2nd Edition, right, is you have a three-action system, which is really cool. Gone are the days of you have a move action, a standard action, a bonus action, a free action, or whatever. However you're coming from, whatever system, you have three actions and a reaction. and you can use those three actions on any things. Most things cost you one action. You know, I'm going to punch that guy. That's an action. I want to draw my sword. That's an action. I want to stand up because I got knocked over. That's an action. Some things, though, like spells and some things like power and like special attacks, like power attack, that, you know, that might be two actions, but still, it's still a very simplistic system. I'm going to move, one action. I'm going to power attack, two actions. Oh, he's a little bit far away. I want to charge him. Okay, sure, cool. Two actions to move, so like move twice and then attack. Bam. Like, you don't need like special, I declare charge, you know, just like, use two actions to get up there and hit him. On top of that, this is an extremely... Okay, look. I know that this is kind of a word that people don't like, but it doesn't have to be, okay? This is a modular system. You pick... Well, I don't want to get too deep into this. We'll get into it later. It's very customizable with your feats and your ancestries and the ancestry feats and the skill feats and, you know.
Yeah, in addition to that, the spine, if you will, of the game, the backbone of the math, is built around what's called the proficiency system, which, you know, is a word you might have heard in other games, but specifically Pathfinder 2nd Edition's proficiency is broken up into five tiers. You are either untrained in something, that means you're not good at it at all, you're trained, you are an expert, you are a master, or you are legendary. And each of those tiers determines how good you are at a thing. It'll give you a relevant bonus. And in addition to that, certain actions, certain abilities, certain feats are locked behind those specific tiers. So if you want to be able to, steal the pants off someone, literally, like they are wearing their pants, but then you sneak up to them and steal the pants off them. You can do that if you are legendary in thievery. Anyone that isn't legendary can't do that, and you'll probably get caught with your hand on someone's pant leg while you're trying to do so. But there are different things that, you know, you have to be at least trained to do a thing, or you have to be at least an expert, and so on and so forth. And those kind of give you an easy gauge to determine how good you are at a thing, and will add bonuses to let your rolls do even better. And depending on how good your rolls are, you might exceed someone's DC or someone's AC or something by a lot. And in that case, you're going to get a critical success, because the other big thing that Pathfinder 2nd Edition has is what's called the degrees of success. There are four different results that you have when you try to attempt something. You succeed, you fail, you critically succeed, or you critically fail. For the most part, those are all always an option. Sometimes there's no critical success, sometimes there's no critical failure, but for the most part, think of those four. And the way you think you would normally get a critical success, you roll a natural 20 on a die. That usually is how you get a critical success, same with a critical failure with a natural one. But the other thing to keep in mind is, because you might be a master or a legendary in something, your bonus might be so high that you exceed someone's, that you exceed your DC by 10 or more. That gets you a critical success. Anytime you roll 10 or better, even if you rolled a 12 on the die, but your result is 10 or higher than what you were looking for, that's a critical success. Same with the inverse. Anything that is 10 or lower than that on the DC will become a critical failure. So there are lots of ways to provide granular success with successes and critical successes, and you can end up doing lots of cool stuff, like literally yelling out so loud that you scare someone to death with your intimidation with a critical success. So those are, I think, the core things about Pathfinder 2nd Edition that really make the game what it is. And of course, from there you'll have things like your classes that give you the specific cool things you can do, and then based on your proficiency you might do critical success, or you know, it takes you three actions to do, you know, you'll mix and match all of that. But that's the core of Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Three actions, very customizable. You will work with the proficiency system to determine your degrees of success.
One of my favorite things about the degrees of success system is that it kind of pads some of the worst case scenario things from older editions. You remember the days of save or die? Like, those, that's not gone. But now you need, like, a critical failure to just outright die. A regular failure just sucks real hard. You know? I love that that's in here.
Yeah, it also lets you not feel bad when you just miss by one or something. On like, a spell attack, for example, you might still deal, like, half damage. Or if someone just barely saves, they might still take half damage against your fireball. Rather than just being all or nothing, there's just some nice nuance there to really kind of flesh out and give you more options, and then just kind of make things feel more interesting a lot of the time.
Now, I understand that welcome to Legend Lore, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition, but for the moment, welcome to Legend Lore, we're going to talk about Pathfinder 1st Edition, because a lot of people love it, very few people hate it. It was a great system, and it obviously gave birth to this system, which I personally prefer, for reasons that we'll talk about. But one of the strengths of 1st Edition was that there were, like, so many options for just your class alone. Like, between all of the base classes and all of the archetypes that modified your base class, I feel like there were at least, like, 500 different, like, classes, maybe. You know, because each archetype is kind of like a mini version of that class. It was just a ton. And if you count third-party options, God, there's got to be thousands. There has to be. There is so much content in 1st Edition, and that's just classes and archetypes. There's also feats, spells. Actually, I think that's probably it. Classes, feats, and spells. Oh, and
Magic items.
Magic item. Yeah. There was so much content in 1st Edition that you could never experience at all, no matter how hard you tried. But 2E is, it might not have your favorite classes and options yet that were in 1st Edition, but that doesn't mean you won't get them. I mean, for example, at the moment of this recording, we're playtesting the Gunslinger. Right? Like, people love the Gunslinger. And one of the complaints when 2E first came out is, where's my Gunslinger? Well, here it is. We're getting there. You gotta remember, like, 1st Edition was out for a long, long time. There's plenty of time to come up with all this cool stuff. But we're getting there. And on top of that, some of the things you loved in 1st Edition are still here. They just look different. For example, take a look at the Blood Rager. I had some really cool Blood Ragers back in 1st Edition. And sure, you're not going to pop open one of our books right now and say, hey, this is the Blood Rager. But it's not hard to do, right? You can take the Barbarian and you can slap a Sorcerer archetype on top of it. Or vice versa. You can take Sorcerer and slap a Barbarian archetype on top of it. Like, there's all kinds of different ways to get to the things that you used to love. And that's one of the strengths. That's one of the strengths of 2E, is that it's modular enough that you can build it how you like it.
Another thing to keep in mind when coming over to 2E is that three action economy is going to end up overall being more flexible for you than what you were doing in first edition. First edition combat, a lot of the time, felt like it devolved into standing still and trying to get your full attack as much as you can, which is great. A lot of people enjoyed that. But now, because there is no full attack, that option's out completely, you suddenly realize, oh, maybe I don't want to just spend all three actions attacking. I feel like I have more things I can do. I can run around more. I can do things like trip and grapple a lot more without feeling like I needed to have gotten all the options for that as well. But yeah, the three action economy opens things up a lot more, and you can mix and match your actions in a way that is a lot easier to parse out and understand. However, I know that a lot of people looking into second edition will feel that the character creation and all the different options might feel a bit more restrictive as well in some ways. The fact that every class has its own set of feats and every ancestry has its own set of feats and things like that means that it's harder to dabble into other stuff like you could in first edition, which, you know, if that's the kind of thing you're looking for, that's totally fair. So do keep that in mind. If you're the kind of person who spent hours and hours just making characters for fun, just, you know, theorizing, coming up with fun ideas for characters, it might not feel the exact same way it did as in first edition.
And I think it's good to mention here that your word choice was impeccable. It might not feel the same way as it did in first edition, but you can still build just about any character you've ever envisioned in Pathfinder 2E. Try it out. There's no character you used to have that you can't remake pretty easily.
So another thing that I guess is restricted in some ways is the underlying math for the game. The first edition rules were such that it was possible to get really ridiculous bonuses to a very specific thing or set of things that you were built for at lower levels. So, you know, something like a plus 40 on a check doesn't sound unreasonable by like level 8 or so in Pathfinder first edition. If you told me, oh, I made a character that gets plus 40 to stealth at level 8, I'd be like, yeah, I'm sure you found a way to do that. That wouldn't surprise me at all. So the math is such that it doesn't get away from you so much. So if you're a GM, you don't have to worry about your players being able to, you know, hit on a natural 2 or being able to basically get free invisibility with every stealth check. The math does eventually, once you're getting into master and legendary proficiency, get pretty big, but everything else is kind of scaling along with you. So a level 20 monster will still probably need you to roll a you know, decently high roll to hit, but anything below that, you're going to absolutely just wreck. Yeah, keep in mind, math is going to be scrunched up a bit compared to what you're used to seeing in Pathfinder first edition if you delved into that, but it doesn't mean you can't be the absolute specialist about your particular thing. It just means that your numbers won't get anywhere near as high, and it might make for easier math on the fly if you're having to do that, but you're more worrying about choosing the right options for yourself rather than getting the biggest numbers. And one testament to that is the fact that the game has trimmed down in the number of different bonus types. You used to have, you know, inherent bonuses, you used to have dodge bonuses, you used to have luck bonuses, and all these other bonus types in first editions, and now there's just three. There's only circumstance and status and item bonuses, so it doesn't get anywhere near as unwieldy as it used to.
Now, as kind of a side effect of the math being so much tighter, the game feels a lot more difficult. Encounters are... it's much easier to go down in an encounter now. I'm not going to say it's easier to straight up die, but it's easier to go unconscious. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the fact that you can still min-max, sure, but min-maxing isn't going to get you where it used to get you, right? Like, you used to be able to, you know, to min-max and just, like, never miss and just always do, like, 100 damage in a round with your halberd. That was my PFS character, by the way, so I know all about that. But you ain't gonna do that now, right? Like now, if I remade that character and I min-maxed as good as I can, or as much as I can, the best I'm gonna get is I'm gonna be good at attacking and I'm gonna be good at dealing damage. But I'm never gonna be an absolute unstoppable murder house relative to the encounters that I'm going into because the math is so tight. Now, another reason I think that it's a little bit more difficult is because I wonder if the dev team that originally put this together kind of, I think maybe they forgot a level. When I first ran my group through 2E, I TPK'd them. I wasn't trying to. Like, I just threw, you know, like, I opened up the book, and it said, like, these are moderate encounters, these are hard encounters, these are severe encounters. I had them through, like, a few quote-unquote easy encounters, like one moderate encounter and one hard encounter. They died. I didn't even push it very much. And I do wonder if, for most groups, it's better to just let your players be one level higher than the adventure calls for. Because it is a deadly system. It is a difficult system. How do you feel about that, though, Luis?
There are two things about that. One, because of the way the math works and to keep things challenging, a single high-level monster is usually much more of a threat than a group of lower-level monsters. So if you need to challenge level 10 players and you throw a level 14 monster at them, that's probably tougher than it is throwing a bunch of level 12 monsters at them. So just because the way the math scales. So yeah, it can be very easy to be like, oh, one of these monsters is a moderate challenge and not realize, oops, that thing is going to crit a lot and it's going to have a lot of hit points and it'll be hard to hit. So one thing to keep in mind when you're designing encounters, try to lean more towards more creatures than single big creatures, unless you really want it to be a really tough challenge, because that is what it can be. And the other thing is the fact that there are fewer bonuses and all this math is, you know, a little tighter here, and no one can solo an encounter anymore and, you know, to see all the spotlight means that it encourages teamwork a lot more. It means flanks are a lot more important. Buff spells and debuff spells are a lot more important. All these other things can be a lot more important, and working together becomes really useful, it turns out. Kind of like it's designed to encourage being a party that works together instead of just being the solo person that goes and beats every fight.
And even in my experience, it really did work like that. Most of my first experiences in a 2E group or 2E party, man, we were getting our teeth kicked in over and over and over again until we really started coordinating, like, hey, I'm gonna need you to move into this position so that I can do this thing. And once you start getting in the habit of really, really cooperating like that instead of everybody trying to do their own thing, that's when the difficulty starts to become what we're more used to in Pathfinder. Now, something else that's pretty different in 2E and from 1E, because you remember how multiclassing was in 1E, right? It was the same as like 3.0 and 3.5 and like all the old ones where you just like, I'm leveling up. Let's pick up Rogue this time. Nah, it ain't like that no more. I actually think this is one of the most elegant multiclassing systems I've seen, okay? What you do now is every even level, you're allowed to take a class feat. It's a specific list of feats for your class. Fighter has like two weapon fighting and like all kinds of just like unique fighter things. And now look, that's not to say other people don't have like some of these same feats. But seriously though, when you get to an even level, you can take something for that class. Or you can pick up an archetype and take something from an archetype feat instead. So instead of taking a fighter specific feat, you can be like, I kind of feel like being a little bit magic-y. And you can take the wizard archetype. And now you're a full BAB fighter. I mean, there is no BAB anymore, but you know what I mean. You're not losing any amount of fighter. And you're adding some cantrips to your repertoire. Level 4, you take another wizard archetype. Now you're a full fighter. You're full plate. You're great sword. You're an absolute just monster in melee. And you've got first level spells. You know, the archetype system really makes it easy to be as good as you want to be at a class while adding some flavor and not sacrificing from your core concept.
Yeah, at your core, you will be the class that you choose at first level. That's never going to change. So if you pick fighter as you level up, you're still going to get fighter stuff, regardless of whether or not you take any more fighter feats from that point on. You're still going to improve at your weapons, your saves are still going to go up and all that. Your numbers won't be changing along the way, which is something that first edition would have, where if you would take first level fighter and then second level is rogue, suddenly my bonus to hit, it's still a +1 because my BAB didn't go up. I guess, you know, that just means I didn't get as good as fighting as I could have. You don't have to worry about any of that. You just dabble and get new abilities from other classes. So you can start stealing the sneak attack from rogues or stealing spell casting from wizards, like you mentioned, or getting even into more specific archetypes to multi-class into, like the archer to get good at archery or things like that. So
the Viking archetype.
The Viking, yes. Yes. there are so many themes out there with the archetypes that you don't even have to worry about, like, oh, well, I want to do magic, but I don't necessarily want to be a wizard. It's like, well, maybe you can be an Eldritch Archer instead. You know, there are lots of ways to get into the things that you want without sacrificing the theme of your character or the focus of your character.
And let me just say it in no uncertain terms, okay? This means that you can start out as a wizard. You can take a fighter feat if you want to at every even level instead of ever taking a wizard feat. And then you can still have 10th level spells. You're not going to lose your spell levels like you would in another system. Because that was the problem, right? Back in the day, man, if you took a spellcasting class, you didn't stop in that spellcasting class because you didn't want to lose your spells. You will never lose your spells now, no matter how much you branch into something else. And I think that is awesome. I love it so much.
Yep, the core concept of the class will stick with you all 20 levels. So another big thing that's different, and it's mostly for you GMs out there, is just how you don't have to worry about all these specific things about proficiency and math and all that stuff when it comes to making your monsters and your NPCs. If you've ever played Starfinder, by the way, which does this too, rather than have you build characters from the ground up using the exact same rules as all the other things that exist in the game, worrying about hit dice and all your ability scores and skill ranks and all that stuff like that, you can make a monster or an NPC just by looking at the right chart, picking the bonuses that you want. Oh, I need this to be a strong monster, so it's to hit, it should be high, but its AC might be low because, you know, it's a glass cannon and it has moderate HP, and then, you know, give it the appropriate amount of saves and damage, and then you've built your monster sometimes in as quick as just a few minutes if you just need stats that are just stats, or, you know, you can take your time and build it out, specifically choosing every number that you want along the way. But the big thing is you don't have to worry about how all the math comes together. The game mastery guide tells you, pick these numbers for this level of creature or level of NPC, and now leaves it up to you to come up with cool abilities that monster does. You don't have to worry about, well, did I give it enough ranks in acrobatics? No, just it has a +20 to acrobatics or whatever. Now let's come up with a cool ability. Yeah, two actions. It can leap out of the ground and, you know, bite someone that's flying above them and pull them down underground. Cool. That's a cool thing. The game prefers that you spend your time thinking about cool things that your monster does rather than worrying about numbers. So that's an easy way to make monsters, and that's going to work differently from how everyone else is playing, but it means it'll be easier to run and easier to work with when you're preparing your own stuff.
Now, if you've been playing first edition for a while, or more specifically, if you've been playing the adventure paths from first edition for a while, you're probably pretty familiar with the world of Galarian. Well, that's still 2E. You still are in Galarian. The only difference is now we're 10 years in the future. So, like, all of those adventure paths, they happened. Last Wall has been destroyed by the Whispering Tyrant, right? Like, Galt is still permanently chopping everyone's heads off, right? It's still Galarian. So you're not going to have to, like, relearn a whole new, like, world or anything.
Yeah, there's no mass disaster that came by and killed a bunch of gods, and you have to learn all the new setting and stuff like
oh,
that.
Oh, God, it's... I hated that so much.
It's the same world. There might be some new changes. There might be, you know, oh, this kingdom is now no longer ruled by this person, but is ruled by their son and stuff like that. Lots of little changes, but for the most part, all the themes and ideas are still there. If you played the adventure paths or were playing with the setting, one thing I recommend is checking out the Lost Omens World Guide, which comes with a timeline at the beginning of the book and gives you a lot of very high-level ideas of like, oh, this is how this AP resolved, and this is how this thing changed, and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't give you exact spoilers. It doesn't say, you know, Rune Lord Karzug was slain by a group of four brave adventurers, one who was an Asimar with... who was a worshiper of Desna and stuff. No, it just says, this happened, and now these are the results. So that's a quick way to get up to speed. And then, you know, looking through the world guide will give you a number of the changes there to bring you to the current day of Galarian. But for the most part, like, other than these changes, it's still going to be the same game. If you've been making your own homebrew version of Galarian, it should still be, for the most part, compatible and very easy to play with and continue on. And keep your campaigns going as they were before.
Still Pathfinder, just a little bit more streamlined without losing any of the depth. Truly, I think what they've done with it is elegant. I think it's 2E is an elegant system. But let's talk about another system which is actually surprisingly elegant. D&D 5th Edition. Luis, have you played much 5th Edition?
Yeah, I've played a bunch. It's very fun game. I like it a lot. I just, looking behind me at all of this Pathfinder stuff I have, I'm kind of invested in one particular game at the moment.
I've played way more 5e than I think I would like to admit. One of my favorite character that I've ever made was actually a 5e character. And right now in my husband's home game is a 5e game, but I've told him. I said, we're not going to play 5e again. Once this campaign's over, we're going to 2e. And I won't. If you want to play with me, then there's no discussion to be had, because that's what's going to happen. If you're coming from 5e, you're used to what? You're used to a movement action.
You're used to an action, movement, and a bonus action. Plus free actions
plus
here.
Plus free actions here. Again, welcome to 2e. We have a three-action economy. So instead of, like, I get this kind of action, you just get three actions. What do you want to do with them? You want to move? Go ahead. You want to move three times? Go ahead. You want to attack three times? Do what you want, man. This is your game. On top of that, you might not... Okay, so look, I know there's some 5e-specific things or some Dungeons & Dragons-specific things that you might be looking for when you come here. Like, man, I really liked my Warlock. Where's the Warlock class? Look, we don't have the Warlock class. We don't do that here. But but we have all of the tools to build it, you know? Like, honestly, we have all kinds of different tools to build all kinds of different kinds of Warlocks. Like, look at the Witch, you know? Look at Sorcerers. Any of these would be a really good facsimile for Warlocks, depending on how you want to build it. And I'll give this to 5th Edition's credit. Look, I do prefer 2E, but there's one thing I think 5th Edition did better, and that is Paladins. I love the way they took the alignment restriction just fully away. They said, you want to be a Paladin? Sure. Pick a god, pick an alignment that makes sense. Have fun. I'm happy that 2E is starting to go in that direction, because now we have, these are the good champions. These are the evil champions. But until the day that I am handed my neutral champions, I'm going to say that 5th did it better.
there's lots of ways to replicate a character or things that you've wanted to do in 5th edition in using Pathfinder 2nd edition rules. So if you had your Tabaxi rogue now you can have a catfolk rogue. It's not called a tabaxi. It's a catfolk now, but it's still a cat person. You know, there's lots of equivalents or something that gets you a very near approximation. And if you're looking at just general things, oh, I used to play a druid. Can I play a druid? Yes. Can I play a wizard? Yes. Most of the classes are there. Warlock isn't there. Artificer isn't there. But, I mean, there's an inventor class coming.
I was going to say, inventor class kind of is artificer. And you have alchemist class. I know you fifth edition people have some weird versions to kind of make an alchemist, but we just threw it. That's a base class. You want to be an alchemist? Boom, alchemist.
Yeah, and for the most part, there's going to be something equivalent or just right on the nose to do just that. And another fun thing is, you don't have to stick with the specific class that you did the first time around to do what you're wanting to do in second edition. If you are an archer, you are a fighter who dabbled in archery and, you know, or champion of archery in first edition or in fifth edition, excuse me. You can be an archer a few different ways now in second edition. You can still do it as a fighter, you can do it as a ranger, which makes sense, but you might be able to do an eldritch archer, which is might be a wizard, or you could be a rogue who dabbles in archery and does, you know, sneak attack with that. There's lots of different ways to kind of do that stuff because of the way the proficiency system works, the way that all the class feats and multi-classing works here. You can choose the thing you want to do and find four or five different ways to get to that goal.
One of my favorite things about 2E, you know what? Now, let me just cut to the chase here. Let me just be real with you for a minute. The thing that makes 2E so good is the options for each of these classes. In 5th edition, you have some options, right? I'm not going to say you can't do it, right? You'd be like, I'm going to be a Pact of the Blade Warlock, or I'll be Pact of the Chain. And then that kind of like defines the way your class is going to level up and stuff. In 2E, each of those options is deconstructed, right? Like, if you imagine all of the class features from all of the different pacts for the warlock, right? And you just chop them all up. You unassign them all from their paths. 2E says at every other level you can take one of these options. You know, so it really lets you build the class however you want to build it.
Yeah, there are lots of times I felt playing 5th edition that I made a few big decisions early on and then I was kind of stuck with what I had. So having options every other level for my class, but not only that, but having something come up every level, if I'm getting an ancestry feat or a skill feat or a general feat, there's just always something I'm looking forward to or trying to decide upon when I level up. And the nature of the game also makes it very easy to become flexible with the way you're playing your character. You can decide, oh, I found this super cool bow and I want to start doing archery stuff, and suddenly start taking archery stuff with your next level up. That's totally fine. There's no way to, like, you don't have to worry about, like, well, I kind of locked in at level 3 to be, you know, this specific thing. I can't do archery anymore. No, you can go back and either retrain to choose archery or start taking archery stuff going forward. There's just always a chance to kind of lean into a different direction with your character.
So way back in the day, right, back in 2E, different 2E, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons 2E, way back in the days of Thaco, you could still do retraining, but it was like extremely taboo almost. Like, there was just this culture of, this is your choice, you have this forever, you know? And, like, we've slowly been slaying that sacred cow. In 2E, if Pathfinder, kind of culminates in that pretty well. Retraining is really simple. It's not going to cost you, like, a ton of gold. It's, you know, if you need to retrain, like a class feat that you took, I don't know, spend, like, a week. Spend, like, 2 weeks on it, you know? And this is great for... This is great for role playing. I'm sorry, but like, this is a way you can seriously show character development. You know, like, I was this kind of person, but I've now found the gods. You know, I've found redemption, and now you can start retraining some of your class feats into like cleric or something. You know, or just something to symbolize the way your character is changing. So yeah, let sacred cows be in the past. You know, Get used to retraining. It's good. It'll help you.
Another thing you're going to need to get used to is the fact that there's going to be a lot of words you're not going to be using in the same way anymore. Advantage and disadvantage or in a post check or surprise rounds aren't a thing anymore. They're not a thing in second edition. If you're a GM used to handing out advantage or disadvantage for a lot of situations, that's not a thing you do so much anymore. You don't have to worry about anyone rolling against each other. There's no ability check, so no one makes a dexterity check or dexterity save or anything like that. So there's a lot of changes with how the game works. Between first edition and second edition, there's a lot of familiar language. There's going to be a lot less familiar language coming from fifth edition for you. So keep that in mind. The game is going to play a whole heck of a lot different compared to what you're used to. So there's, you know, just know that there's a lot of extra rules to add in and keep in mind, but that may feel good, may feel bad. I don't know. Just know that, you know, trying to get advantage for a reason or arguing with your GM that you might have advantage here. It's not a thing anymore.
I'm going to say, so even though there is a lot of different rules, I'm not sure that it's more complicated than 5e was, especially because this three action system simplifies things so much. Surprise rounds may be gone, but that doesn't mean surprise is gone. Your GM will just give you a bonus or a negative to your initiative, you know? All of the different ability saving throws and stuff, you don't gotta worry about that. You just got three. I really don't think it's more complicated. It's just gonna be different, you know?
Another thing to get used to is that the math is nowhere near as tight. There's no more bounded accuracy compared to 5th edition. It is bounded, but in a far larger stretch than it is before. 5th edition, you would get your proficiency bonus up to +6 and maybe get your ability score up a bit, and you're maybe rolling like a +15 or something, which is pretty good. Here, you're going to be looking at anywhere up to like even up to +40, depending on how good you are and if you're a legendary and all this other stuff, and if you're at maximum level, it can get really big. So your numbers are going to get really big. Your AC is going to get big. Your saving throws are going to get big. If you like big numbers, look forward to those, but know that you're going to have to keep track of a fair number of different ability scores and skill checks and all these different things that can get up to pretty high values.
And there are some really good advantages to this from even a narrative standpoint. Like in 5e, when you level up and your proficiency doesn't go up and none of your numbers go up, your HP goes up, but you really don't feel like your character has gotten any stronger, you know? That was one of my biggest complaints with 5e. I leveled up. What do I get? Maybe nothing. Maybe just some hit points and, like, I don't know, you can sing a different song or something. I don't know. But that's the thing is, like, I have so much trouble remembering because there was so little that you get, right? You're not going to have that no more. Your number's always going to go up at least by one, maybe more if your proficiency goes up. You're always going to get, like, some kind of feat, maybe a skill feat, maybe a class feat. Yeah. I think it doesn't have to be a problem. I think it can feel pretty good.
Yeah. The lack of bounded accuracy also means that the assumptions of the game are a lot different when it comes to encounters. The bounded accuracy made it such that a low-level monster might still kind of pose a decent enough challenge, even at higher levels, or an adventuring group might have a decent shot at taking on a very high-level monster with, you know, the right tools at hand. But here, if you try to go after a monster that's, like I mentioned earlier, 4 levels higher than you, you're going to have a very rough time. Not saying you're going to lose necessarily, but you probably are going to get hurt a lot. You're going to use up a lot of spells. You're going to use up your potions. Some of you might get knocked unconscious or even die. It's not as easy to challenge things outside of your kind of level range, which might be something that you're used to doing and having fun with, or might give you more of that fantasy that you wanted, where it's suddenly like, oh, I can't go fight a pit fiend at level 12 or whatever, and it's going to be a real challenge, and make them scarier and make it more interesting and make the world feel more nuanced and real.
If you're new to the system, you might not realize that one of the reasons it makes it so much harder than, say, coming from even first edition Pathfinder is because you're not just getting hit more often with their higher numbers. You're getting crit more often, too, because of the grades of success. You hit an enemy who's going to be, like, four levels higher than you. Man, they might start critting you on, like, 10 or 11. Like, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough. But in a way, that's not really that much of a problem. Because now you've got to make a really interesting decision for your characters, right? Narratively, okay? Do you run away, live to fight another day? Do you knuckle down and acknowledge that sacrifices are going to have to be made, but you're going to win this tough fight? I mean, you're really going to feel like you've earned all of your victories in this edition because of the math.
Speaking of math, another way that your math is going to be messed with is all the different magic items you're going to get. I don't know how every single 5e game has been going, but I know a lot of assumptions of the 5e rules are such that magic items are rare and they're very special and stuff, and that's great, but that means some groups might only have like a single plus one weapon among their entire party. Some groups might have gotten dozens of plus one weapons and have them all over the place. It varies, but Pathfinder 2nd Edition assumes that you're getting magic items continually. It's built into the assumptions of the game. We expect you to get a plus one sword about 2nd or 3rd level, and then, you know, so on and so forth, and the game works with that, and that means you can have cool treasure, get cool items all the time, and not just rely on what your class can do. You might find cool stuff and decide, hey, my Cape of the Montback lets me teleport around, and now I want to fight with that and do a lot of more teleporting stuff. Suddenly your character is doing a lot of different things just based on the cool items that they've gotten. We mentioned earlier that Pathfinder 1st Edition has very different multiclassing, and 5th Edition D&D also has very different multiclassing compared to 2e. Similar to 1st Edition Pathfinder, in 5e D&D, when you multiclass, you kind of dedicate your entire level to that new class, and you have to, you know, meet specific ability score requirements. You might need like a 14 or a 16 in dexterity or something to get your multiclassing. And then from then on, you're getting a diet version of the class, I feel, compared to getting just the exact level of, you know, first level of that class and so on, like you would in first edition. And that sometimes feels discouraging when you wanted to try another thing, but feel like you're not getting that much out of it. So compared to the D&D multiclass, 5e, or the 2e multiclass is still giving you a lighter version of the full class. You're not getting every single thing that class is doing, but you're not giving up as much for it. You're giving up a single class feat, which means that the trade-off feels a lot better, at least in my eyes. So if I give up a class feat, but I get a class feat from another class, or get it, you know, the ability to cast spells, that's probably sometimes even a trade up for that, compared to losing an entire level worth of stuff and missing out on both my latest level of my main class and a full level of the class I wanted to go into. So there's a lot of ways to do that with the multi-classing to get good stuff. And as we mentioned earlier, you can multi-class into themes rather than necessarily classes. So multi-class into archer, multi-class into Viking, multi-class into, you know, any number of different themes that are in there that show up all over the place. There's dozens of archetypes at this point. So you can kind of pick and choose your specific way to multi-class and dedicate as little or as much of you want, much as you want to that multi-class as well.
I do think that a lot of times you are trading up when you go down these multi-class archetype routes. For example, what's a level 2 class feat? Luis, name a level 2 class feat.
Level 2 class feat.
Yeah.
A level 2 rogue feat is...
We just need one.
Quick draw.
Okay, so at level 2, you could get quick draw, where you could What is it? Draw and strike with one action?
Yeah.
Or you can pick up the sorcerer dedication, and you can get two cantrips and proficiency in one of the magical knowledges. And these cantrips, y'all, this is the same sorcerer cantrips that a regular sorcerer gets, right? At level 10, you will cast them as a fifth level spell. You can use them infinitely. They're great. I feel like that's definitely a trade-up from being able to draw and attack with one action.
There's so many different things we can talk about that are different between the two games at this point. But the last point I want to bring up is that Galarian is not Faerun. The Age of Lost Omens is not the Forgotten Realms. The worlds, the assumed worlds of both games are similar enough where a lot of things will feel familiar. There are orcs, there are trolls, there are goblins, there are wizards, there are fighters, there are clerics, there are deities, and all that stuff. A lot of that will translate very easily. You'll be able to pick it up. You know, you'll just have to learn different names. So, you know, the goddess of the sun is now Sarenrae. You know, stuff like that. But there will be a lot of little differences that might make or break your idea of what fantasy is. Who knows? It might not affect you at all. But, you know, if you're used to throwing mind flares at the party or having to fight a beholder, that's no longer around. That's only in D&D realms. Now, at home, if you wanted to, you could, in theory, bring those monsters over. But by default, if you pull up the bestiary and go page by page, it's not going to line up. You're not going to see Avalith, and then Beholder. No, it's Bahir. What happened? Where's the Beholder? You know, they don't line up perfectly, and that's to be expected. It's not the exact same world, so there's going to be lots of little differences, lots of big differences. Goblins are a playable ancestry straight out of the gate without requiring an extra book. There's, if you like that kind of stuff, great. Just remember, it is high fantasy, but a lot of the stuff you might be used to and might love from the adventures from D&D and stuff like that might not be there, and might need some work to bring them over.
Now, if you're coming in from other systems, like some of the systems I've played are any of the World of Darkness systems, Fate. I've had a lot of fun in Mutants and Masterminds. If you're coming from some of these systems, well, welcome. We're extremely happy to have you. This is a D20 system, though. So you might have to get used to it being kind of swingy. There's some variants of it, like the bell curve variant where you roll 3d6 instead of 1d20, but I've never met a group that uses it.
Yeah, so if a dice pool system like in the World of Darkness games, you know, it's significantly different from your D20, and sometimes your D20 might be the biggest factor in whether or not you succeed compared to your bonuses. And that sometimes doesn't feel good. Sometimes it leads to interesting stuff, but it's a thing to keep in mind. As I just mentioned here, it is high fantasy, so there is no modern day stuff. There is no 1920s jazz era weird Cthulhu stuff going on. There's high fantasy that might not be as gritty as something like Game of Thrones or anything like that. So if you're looking for that, welcome. If not, just be aware that this is a thing to be expected.
That's right. Don't expect any crashed spaceships and laser rifles. Right, Luis? Right? None of that?
No, none of those. No ancient Egyptian stuff. No weird Wakanda-style high magic in an African setting. Nothing like that. Of course not. Mm-hmm. No. I mean, the world of Galarian is actually very very varied and actually has places for lots of different types of fantasy. So if you're into Gothic fantasy, you can go to Ustalav. If you want ancient Egypt, you can go to Assyria. And so it is high fantasy, but there's a lot of chances to go into other different types of fun fantasy or adventure tropes.
Now, let me admit here, okay? Just from my history, I still know more about Faerun than I do about Galarian. So let me tell you, one of the biggest differences between these two systems is that Faerun had different countries and stuff, and it felt like different countries. Now, okay, I'm not going to sit here and say Galarian didn't have different countries. It does. But they don't feel like only different countries. Like, they really do feel like completely different entire settings with their own themes.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's almost like different, like, video game worlds every time you cross the border, you know?
It's, if you've ever been to Disneyland or know Disneyland or Disney World, it's very much the feeling of like Frontierland is right next to the Magic Kingdom. And those are two very different flavors.
It's exactly next to, like that.
Next to Tomorrowland, which is an even more drastic flavor. You can go across the border and suddenly be effectively in a brand new world.
Yeah. A lot of times, Faerun, you know, you felt like you were driving, you know, from Illinois to Indiana, like when you crossed a country, like it wasn't that different, you know. Sometimes it was, but not really. No, Galarian makes a big deal out of it, which means that there's a lot of room to tell exactly the kind of story that you want to.
If you're coming over from something like Fate or from the World of Darkness or anything like that, which is a more storytelling heavy game, the apocalypse world, dungeon world stuff, know that there are a lot of rules here that tell you specifically what you can do or can't do with a given thing. There's a lot of crunch, a lot of very specific stuff. Climbing a slippery wall while it's raining might be specifically a DC 24 or whatever, you know, things like that, compared to the more kind of off the cuff, more freeform style of game that those are. So welcome to the crunchy simulationist world of Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
And where do you store like a whole bunch of different rules? Well, you keep them in books. We have a lot of books in Pathfinder, but you don't got to let that intimidate you, right? If you're a player, all you need is the core rule book. If you're going to GM, you should probably have the core rule book and maybe the bestiary. Boom, you're good to go. And on top of that, all of these rules are for free online if you go to the Archives of Nethys, you know?
Yeah, and I know it is as big as a textbook. Don't let that scare you off, but the core rule books is very dense. All these other rules or other books are just additional. They're supplementary, extra options, or new information on the setting. But there's a lot of them, and if you want to get the full lore dive, you also have 10 years worth of first edition lore and setting material to go nab up as well.
If you're coming in to Pathfinder, or really any of the D20 based systems, you should expect that you're going to have a lot of combat. You know, it's not going to be a rare thing that happens sometimes. You're going to have it quite a bit. But now I want to go on record saying this, because I've seen a lot of criticisms about Pathfinder that all the combat gets in the way. It's not a role-playing system. Nah, folks, don't listen to that. Role-playing is what you make it, right? If you're letting combat ruin your role-playing, then stop. Like, just don't do that. Like, there's no reason for it, you know? It. Look, we can do, if there's interest in it, we can do some other episodes about, like, how to improve the role-playing in your Pathfinder group, if there's interest in that. Let us know in our comments on Discord or on the No Direction website, and we'll put that together for you.
So that's a brief rundown of what to expect if you're coming from other systems. There's too many systems out there for us to compare very specific things, but I think that plus listening to everything we talked about for the differences between first edition and fifth edition should probably prepare you for what to expect, at least when you first start reading Pathfinder. So I think if you're still interested, you can give it a try, and if you're not committed into like getting a full $60 rule book plus the extra $40 for the bestiary and all that stuff, I think one great starting point would be the Pathfinder Beginner Box. It comes with the trimmed down version of the rules. These aren't alternative versions or easier versions. It's the actual rules. It just, you know, doesn't have every single class in it and every single magic item, for example, stuff like that. But it gives you just enough to try the game out, get a bit of play in. Comes with a free adventure in there and all the stuff you need to get started and basically play a couple sessions, you know, get you up to about third level, and you can work from there and decide if that's the game you like and want to do more of, or if maybe not for you. But if you're trying it out, I think the beginner box is the way to go.
And after you've gotten all the way through the beginner box, you've decided if 2E Pathfinder is really for you. After all that, make sure you check out the rest of our content on the No Direction Network. Because if you like this show or any of our other blogs or shows, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/nodirection, because it's the support of our patrons that make this all possible.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore. And as always, it's been legendary.